Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with a scholar who's an important figure in the field of linguistics, one of the pioneers in sociolinguistics, which is the study and examination of the ways that society shapes the way that we speak. He is also well known for research into regional dialects here in the United States. His name is William Leboeuf, and he is a professor in the linguistics department at University of Pennsylvania. He's authored a number of books, one on looking at Black vernacular English. He has two volumes, Principles of Linguistic Change, and one that deals with the area that we'll talk about here this morning is the Atlas of North American English, which has just come out. It's a major kind of reference work, kind of you no doubt would find in the library, and we'll talk a little bit about that and also about the larger subject of regional dialects. I think that the expectation, I'm sure many people's expectation would be that now that we're in a mass media age, and we have people, all of us across the country, watching the same television and seeing the same movies and in many cases listening to the same voices on the radio, that that would mean that regional dialects would be disappearing, or at least they would somehow blur so that more and more we would all sound the same. But in fact, I think our guest would say that regional differences in the way that English is spoken continue to flourish. And we'll talk more about that here this morning in this part of the show. He's visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. The folks here in the linguistics department have brought him to give a couple of talks. He gave one last night on this very subject, and we're pleased that he could be here and speak with us. Questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. If it would be long-distance call for you, use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll free 800-222-9455. Thanks for being here. We appreciate it.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
I do think it seems counterintuitive that, as I said, in a time when we do have mass media that everyone is bathed in, that not only would we continue to have regional differences in vocabulary and in pronunciation, but that those things continue to be very strong. But that apparently is the case.
Right. It's bad news for the mass media if you think that you're controlling the way your listeners behave. But if you're willing to say that you're simply communicating information, that's okay. The way we speak is very close to the way we are. And apparently it's mostly influenced by the people you talk to, where what they say makes a difference to what you're going to say.
Pardon me. There, a moment there, it seemed to be getting a little feedback, and I was thinking that maybe your headphones might have been turned up really kind of loud. How many major dialects are there in the United States?
Well, in our basic map, there's about 16, depending how you cut them up. But the most important ones for us at the moment are what we call the North, this huge region around the Great Lakes area, and the Midland, which is just south of that, down to the Ohio River, and then the South, as most people recognize it. Mm-hmm. So our studies were carried out in the 90s with a telephone survey that covered the whole continent of North America in about 5 years. And we put that together into this atlas, which showed, just as you said, that the regional dialects are getting stronger and stronger and more different. So the people in Los Angeles, St. Louis, Chicago, New York are now talking more differently than they did 100 years ago.
Is that somehow a result of a deliberate effort on people's parts to hold on to their regional accent?
No, people are not aware at all of what we're talking about, particularly in this area, in the Midland and the North. It's quite unconscious. In the South, people are more aware of what they're doing, and some people will consciously try to be a little more Southern or get away from being Southern, but those are the minority. In most cases, language changes without anyone being aware that it's happening. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, one of the things that we know over time is that different people's efforts to get language to change deliberately. If there have certainly been many cases where someone has been concerned about use or misuse, or they thought that somehow language could be improved, and have tried intentionally to get people to change the way that they speak. And it seems that that's never been successful.
Not never. Some words do get wiped out by being stigmatized. But if you go back to the 19th century, what were people really worried about trying to object to? The word jewelry. What a horrible word, jewelry.
They didn't. What about that word did they not like?
It was a neologism, what the really meant of people's jewels. What about execute? That was a word that people campaigned against over and over again. Execute merely means to do. How can you use it to mean to kill somebody in the electric chair? So the words that got people terribly upset in the 19th century are perfectly not only okay, but we can't imagine why they were so upset about them. Yeah.
So after a while, people just get – if enough people continue to use a word in a certain way, that people initially might object when it's new, but eventually it will be such a – it'll be such a common part of speech that then people will say, well, they'll look back and say, well, why did anybody – what was their problem with that?
Well, look, we're all the same whether we're linguists or not. We feel that somehow language was born in a state of perfection, and any change is a terrible loss. So even if we study language in a scientific and objective way, we have this feeling that, well, let me put it very simply. Of the thousands of people we've interviewed, nobody has ever said, you know, the way kids talk today is so much better than the way we talked when I was a kid.
No, never. It has never happened. Well, I'd like to go back to the idea of the fact that not only do we continue to have regional dialects, but that they continue to, if anything, they get stronger. And why that happens, if it's not because people are deliberately holding on to their accents, why does that happen? I guess I'm still thinking about the fact that people do hear a lot of other voices that will be different from their own.
But these local accents develop in local areas, but in this particular case, we're talking about a way of speaking in the northern United States around the Great Lakes, which stretches from Buffalo, Syracuse, Rochester, Cleveland, Detroit, Gary, Chicago, Milwaukee, Madison. In that vast area, this is the kind of thing that's happening. People in 1950 used to say, I've got a job. Today it's, I've got a job. In 1950, people might say, that's what happens. And today it's, that's what happens. So the whole series of six vowels, which we call the short vowels of English, used to stay put. For 1,000 years, we said them pretty much the same. And then about the middle of the last century, they began to rotate in this area. And no one, even today, is aware of it. An announcer, for example, was saying what I heard as, well, the traffic was jammed solid.
Salad. Like that green stuff that you put dressing on. Yeah.
There's a lot of misunderstanding based on it. But as far as people thinking about it or doing it consciously, no, that's not the name of the game. Mm-hmm. This is something that happens to the language, but the users of it are quite unconscious of just what's happening. When they become aware of it, they try to fix it and change it. But by then, it's too late.
Why does it happen? Does anyone know?
Well, that's in the lecture I just gave, I start off by saying, here are some of the things that are happening. Here are the effects. The causes are pretty mysterious, and that's our research frontier. And there are lots of causes. Some of them are just mechanical. It says that it's like a boulder rolling down a hill. It starts in one direction, it's got to go. But there's also the feeling that the Great Lakes area has its own ideology, its own underlying politics, and that somehow the language is associated with it. And people, little kids growing up, just push it further and further. We're investigating that in the best way we can, but the Atlas doesn't try to explain everything we found. It shows them what's happening, so if you want to know how people are talking in your town, you look it up and you can hear people from the town speaking. You can hear the same word pronounced all over the continent of North America in different ways.
Mm-hmm. I guess one of the things that it suggests to me is that when you think about what are the forces that are important in shaping the way that each of us speaks as an individual, that mass media, I would think it certainly has a role, but that perhaps more important are the people that we spend time with, family, friends, coworkers, the people who are checkers at the grocery store, all of the people that we come in contact with in our daily lives, those voices, as we hear them and tune, we all sort of tune to each other, are probably more important than than Brian Williams or Katie Couric or, you know, whoever you would pick out of the mass media as being a frequently widely heard individual voice.
The general theory of the mass media, as I understand it, is that information flows not to the whole population, but to a few people who get the word, and that most people orient themselves to their friends and acquaintances. Mm-hmm. So that's what advertisers are trying to do today, to reach those few people who are actually the ones they can influence. We are reacting to the people around us, where what they say makes a difference to what we say, and what we say makes a difference to what they say. Now, we haven't talked about kids. It's kids who are doing this. They're the ones who are moving it forward. Mm-hmm. So a child grows up with a mother who said, what happens? And he or she goes to school where the kids are saying, what happens? And then by the time they graduate from school, they're saying, what happens? And this is a pretty mysterious process. Mm-hmm. For the language to advance like that, the child has to learn what the parent says, start from there, and then go further and further and further. And what's driving that further is still pretty mysterious. So, for example, people in Chicago, Cleveland area, used to say, oh, my name is Debbie. And then and a generation later, it was Dubby. And now it's Dubby. So that shift of the vowels in that direction produces a lot of misunderstanding across generations. And when someone visits Chicago, the chances are they'll miss out on a lot of words.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure no matter where you come from, if you go somewhere else where people speak differently, what you'll say is, boy, the folks here talk really funny.
Yeah, we all naturally feel that. I'm the only person I know who doesn't have an accent, actually.
We have a caller here. We'd be happy to bring others into the conversation. Our guest is William LaBeouf. He's professor of linguistics at the University of Pennsylvania and has been working in this area for a long time. He is one of the editors of the Atlas of North American English. It came out in 2006 that explores this subject that we're talking about, and that is the persistence of and the characters of regional dialects. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call in. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller on line one in Champaign. Hello.
Hi there.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up 70 miles south of here, and I came to Champaign-Urbana, to the big city, to come to school, and found out there was a whole lot of people from up north who came down to Champaign-Urbana and to Hicksville. And I remember my first weeks, I think, in the dorm, there was a girl going up and down the halls. She was desperate. She was looking for some facts. She needed some facts. And I had a brown paper one that I got at the grocery store, and I tried to give them to her, and she was just totally baffled. She was looking for a pair of socks, and what I'd given her was not a sack, but a bag. And that was my first introduction to the language barrier between Chicago and southern part of Illinois. I think I probably still call them socks, not sacks, but I've tried to take the R out of Warsh, and I think I've successfully done that. Other than that, I don't think I've modified my accent too much. That's all I had to say.
But that's a wonderful example. We have done a lot of experiments where we played speech of young people in as isolated words to people from Birmingham, Chicago, and Philadelphia. And one of the second item we play sounds like this. Sacks, sacks, and then later on you hear the person say, "Had to wear sacks," and then later on, "Had to wear sacks, no sandals," and there is exactly the same misunderstanding that you had. And we like to think that our experiments really touch on the things that happen in everyday life. So your experience says, yep, those are the misunderstandings that language change produces. All the words that are spelled with short O, like socks and got, move forward till some people are going to misunderstand them as sounding like short A.
Mm-hmm. And to do this work, to do the kind of work that you do, part in part what you do is take particular words that are telling, that are good indicators, and then what you have done is to travel around different parts of the country and I think literally with that word written on a card, and you just show it to the person and you say, say this for me.
Well, no, we do that sometimes, but these were experiments done with in those three cities. The Atlas is accomplished by calling up people on the telephone. And over 5 years, we covered all of North America, and the first two people to answer that telephone and said, yes, I was born in this town become representatives of that area. And then we talk to them for an hour or so, and we try to get them to say all the words without our saying it. Sometimes we mail them a list of words to read, but essentially we get them asking questions like, well, what's the difference between mad and angry? And people are really interested in that, and in so doing they say mad or mad or mad, right? Then we also get involved in spontaneous speech. What do you think is the topic that's most interesting to people in all across the continent? It's what's happening downtown, what's happening to our city. So if I was going to talk to people in Urbana and I wanted to get some good, excited conversation, I get into what's happening downtown, and I understand that that is an issue.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. In terms of downtown development,
Now, it so happens that in the city of Pittsburgh, a unique city, downtown is pronounced Dantan. So it comes up over and over again.
Dantan.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are there places where, let me just ask right out. Is there some place where the diversity is the greatest? That is, if you go, and I would expect it would be in a metropolitan area, if you go some city and you walk around long enough and you listen to people, you'll hear the greatest number of different dialects.
If you're looking for a person born and raised in that area, don't go to Phoenix, Arizona. Sometimes on the West Coast, we might have to call 100 times to get a person who's really local. Mm-hmm. But those dialect areas, particularly in the West, are not crisply, sharply formed into a new dialect yet. So, on the other hand, if you go to the East, particularly New England, you can get very different dialects within a short distance. But within the city itself, you must remember that all the big cities now have very large percentages of African-American and Latino people. And what we're talking about right now is characteristic of the white population because particularly African-Americans who have their own way of speaking and developing it, they speak perfectly standard English, but they do not enter into these local developments of the local white speech.
Mm-hmm. Certainly in some places around the country, we have increasing numbers of people who speak Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
Has that had an influence on English? And if the answer is not yet, do you think that it will?
No, the general picture is that those who got there first determine the nature of the language, even if they're a small group, and large numbers of people coming afterwards, up to a certain limit, are not going to change that. But Latino people are in a special position because they go in different ways. In each of the studies we've done in various parts of the country, we find that some Latino speakers go in the direction of African-American speech, close associated with them. Others pick up the local white vernacular and sound like the people from Philadelphia. And the third group retains a strong Spanish orientation, and their English, even second, third generation, shows certain small differences from the general population.
Hmm. Let's talk with someone else. We have an Urbana listener here. This is on our line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a friend who is an interpreter. He's an English to Spanish, the other way, interpreter. And we often argue that I see that there must be some sort of standard English, you know, that there must be like the proper way to say things. Is that true? Is there something like that?
Well, we don't have an academy that tells you there's a right way to speak in English. The broadcast media have guides to pronunciation. And what we hear from NBC, CBS broadcasters is a kind of approximation to that blurs and brings people to a closer standard. But it's not correct. For example, though the broadcast pronunciation might be route, not route, nobody's going to say that route is incorrect. So we don't have that absolute standard of what is right or wrong, and there's a lot of variation in the United States of America.
Interesting. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Do you find that at the area that is the boundary between major dialect areas, that you do get a kind of a blurring so that somewhere in the middle there are people that are a little bit like the people on both sides?
Now you're onto the topic of the talk I'm giving tonight. It's called the deepest division in America. The people who did the original work in dialectology, which is very good, using words and vocabulary, said it's a continuum, just as you said. Mm-hmm. But in pronunciation, we find, no, there's a very, very sharp line, and it runs through the upper third of Illinois here. Most of Indiana is in what we call the Midland, but the Cleveland and the New York State is along the other line. And when you cross that line, you're, well, let me give one example. There's a pair of words that sometimes the same, sometimes different for speakers of American English. C-O-T, you say?
Caught.
And C-A-U-G-H-T?
Caught.
Like night and day. But
to
many
me,
of our listeners are going to say caught and caught for both. Hawk and hawk, don and don. And this leads to a tremendous amount of misunderstanding. I have dozens and dozens of cases where somebody says, I'm looking for a coffee shop. And one says, you want to have a, you just had your coffee. Copy and coffee.
Oh, I think.
So this one half of our continent, people say these two sets of words the same. The other half, they say them different. And when you go down from Chicago and the suburbs through Kankakee and to Springfield and Bloomington, you're moving from an area where those two sounds are very different to where they're almost the same. Now, in our large Midland area of Illinois and most of Indiana, they're not very far apart. And the feeling is that they're almost together. Mm-hmm. So people say, caught, 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 caught. So that line is pretty sharp. Now, north of that line, people say, no doubt about it. South of that line, people say, no doubt about it. You hear the difference?
Mm-hmm.
We, by the way, we can talk about this on the radio. Very hard to describe in print. That's why I think radio is just built to talk about language sounds.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk with someone else here on cell phone on our toll-free line. It's line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
In an earlier part of the conversation, you categorized the broader dialect areas and referred to the South. I grew up in the Deep South, and it's been my observation over the years that people who in Texas speak considerably different from someone, say, that grew up in rural South Georgia, and then different again from someone who grew up in Virginia. I wonder if you'd comment on the various nuances of the Southern dialect, and I'd like to hang up and listen over the air, please.
All right. Well, thank you.
Well, the South is just as you described, full of differences, but those differences are getting less within the South. Particular cities like Charleston are losing their local dialect. The big cities like Atlanta and Houston and Dallas are very much influenced by Northern speech. So the difference between the South and the North is this. The bigger the city in the North, the stronger the accent. In the South, the smaller the town, the stronger the accent. And many of the big cities are influenced by these big immigrations of Northerners. But if we look now at the particular sounds being made, that is becoming a little more general. If you want to talk about my friend Guy is pretty high in this establishment, that tendency to say I as ah is pretty solid throughout the South. Where the differences come up, which I'm sure you've noticed, is before the words that end in PTK and S, like Naswat Ras. There, in most of the South, we find that it's a social class difference, and lower class people say nas, ras, whopping up the countertop. And people with more education say nice and white and rice. But in large areas that are of the South, in around Appalachia, Birmingham, Knoxville, Asheville, Greenville, we find that all those words are pronounced as ah by the people with the most education. So those are some of the differences we find in the South. Texas is certainly different from North Carolina. Virginia, you mentioned, one of the characteristics of Virginia used to be what we call Canadian raising. We people say right about no, as opposed to how now, brown cow. And that we didn't find in our atlas. It's disappeared, and the difference between Virginia and North Carolina is getting to be less. So within these big regions, You're losing some of the local differences, but the regions themselves are staying apart and are sometimes more and more different.
Yeah. Are the regional dialects somehow based on the fact that people came to the United States with other languages, and that, for example, people in the northern Midwest came from Scandinavia, and that at some time in the past, maybe people in the southeast came from places in the British Isles, in Scotland, and places like that, and that they came with languages, they may have come with languages other than English, and that language then has helped to shape that dialect?
It's certainly... The start of our big differences was in what part of the British Isles people came from. And in a book by David Hackett Fisher called Albion Seed, he traces these four hearths. New England from the eastern Anglia, East Anglia area particularly. And the other big difference was the Quaker Philadelphia group. And then there was the Virginia Planters and the Upland Southerners. And as they moved westward, they carried their cultural patterns with them, and that was part of the start of it. Scandinavians coming into Minnesota are responsible for it. If you go to our atlas and you look up Minnesota, you hear that long go. So that influenced it. But having said that, in most of our areas, it doesn't make any difference where your folks came from, how you talk. And we get these solid blankets, solid areas of language differences, which are independent of whether the person is of German background, Italian, Irish, Polish, Ukrainian, Jewish, or whatever. Most of the towns in the United States, the biggest single input was German. That's the most. And yet, if you take the people who have German background, Irish, or it won't make that much difference. The big, big differences, of course, are race and as we now describe it. But in terms of what language your folks spoke, the special cases like Minnesota are really special. In most of the areas, it doesn't make that much difference. Mm-hmm.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is William LaBeouf. He's professor of linguistics at University of Pennsylvania and has been doing work in the area of linguistics for a long time. He's one of the pioneers in the field of sociolinguistics, which is basically, as I understand it, the study of the way that society shapes the way we speak. He's also interested in language change and in dialects, and he's authored a number of books. And if you're interested in this particular subject, the book that you would want to look at is one that he co-authored. It's titled The Atlas of North American English and came out last year. And if you're interested in looking at the book, you head down to the library. You should be able to find a copy. Also online, and there you will find audio examples of the things that we're talking about, right?
Well, if your library has bought the Atlas, you'll get access to this website, which allows you to hear the sounds, same words spoken in different ways all across North America. Hear samples of speech from each individual and get away from these phonetic descriptions, which is the technical part of it, and actually hear. Everybody wants to know how do they talk in my town and be sure we got it right. And to our great surprise, the first two people that answer the phone and represent that town usually fit in with the whole pattern, even though most of us move across the United States at great rate.
Yeah. Questions are welcome. We have some others who are waiting. And the number 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Alex, taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question. I grew up in Buffalo, New York. And after that, I moved to Pittsburgh for college. And when I got there, a lot of people thought I talked so strange. I sounded very funny, especially people from other parts of New York. And they thought I was from, completely different regions like Wyoming or something because of how I talked. And, I couldn't hear it really. But every time I would talk to friends or family on the phone in Buffalo or go back to Buffalo for a while and then come back, my friends would say, there you go again, talking like you did before. After a while, it went away a bit. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the sounds from that region, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Oh, don't hang on. I want to ask you a question.
Okay.
Have you been through Erie?
Have I been to Erie?
Yeah.
Yes.
You ever go on vacation there? To the lake?
I've been to the lake, yeah.
The reason I'm asking you is that the city of Erie is unique. It's the only city in the United States that's changed its allegiance from the north to this Midland area and has become like Pittsburgh. So when you went from Buffalo to Pittsburgh, you were following the same path as those people from Erie, except that the people from Erie have picked up the Pittsburgh accent. So, for example, how do you say C-O-T?
C-O-T?
Yeah. Like a bed.
C-O-T?
Yeah.
Is that an
acronym? No, the word, like a small bit.
Oh,
and then
cut?
The past tense of catch?
Catch?
The past tense
cut?
Of... Yeah, that's it. Say those
cut.
Two again.
Cut.
And the other?
Cut.
They sound the same, huh? Or do they sound different?
They sound relatively the same to me.
Well, that you picked up from Pittsburgh. You didn't bring that from Buffalo. So you have learned something from those Pittsburgh fellows. So we're interested in the city of Erie because it's right in between Buffalo, Cleveland, and Pittsburgh.
Right. A lot of people say that I say words like man and apple and bagel strangely.
Well, that's your Buffalo heritage. Now, you share that to a certain extent with our one of our leading candidates, Hillary Clinton, because she was raised in Chicago, but she's accused of becoming a carpetbagger because people say you sound like Buffalo. Well, Buffalo and Chicago are really the same dialect.
Okay.
So did you like Pittsburgh?
Yes, I did. I did. They had some very unique accents themselves, I thought.
Yeah. Did you learn to say downtown?
Yes, downtown.
There you go. You learned a lot. Well,
yes.
It's great talking with you about it.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Is it not the case that Pittsburgh does have a very a unique kind of accent there, the Pittsburghers have?
They're very conscious of it, too. They talk a lot about yins.
Yins, which is their version of y'all.
Right. And it's the only reasonable thing to do to distinguish between you and you, meaning one person or two people. So yins is the Pittsburgh way of doing it. And they have all kinds of other expressions that they're very proud of. But new things are happening in Pittsburgh, too. Our Atlas shows that... when those words C-O-T and C-A-U-G-H-T, cot, cot, don, hawk, hawk, become the same, another word drops down into the slot where they used to be, which is the words that are pronounced with short U, like duck. Mm-hmm. So our Pittsburgh people will say, you crack like a duck. And people think that it was cracking like a dock. So Pittsburgh has its own system, and it's... one of the most unusual cities in that people are so conscious of it and discuss their own dialect in the newspapers.
Mm-hmm. And they feel proud enough of it so that they're determined that they're going to hold on to the thing that makes them different?
Yeah, but as usual, you talk about the things that we call stereotypes, where there's a name for them. The new things that are happening are below the surface. Yeah. But I think that Pittsburgh is one of those cities where people are not easily pushed around by the bigger cities.
All right. We have other callers. Next, someone in Urbana. This is line two. Hello?
Well, guten Tag, meine Herren. just to bring back and reference the German influence, but my question doesn't concern that. For the author, have you ever matched up the dialect map with, for instance, the map of North America... created by Joel Giroux way back in 1980 when he wrote his book, The Nine Nations of North America, in which he decided to do away with all the official political boundaries and just see how regional attitudes, along with some differences in dialect, were developing in North America. Have you even heard of the
book?
No,
I don't know. It sounds extremely interesting. Will you give me the reference again?
Yes, the book is The Nine Nations of North America by Joel Giroux.
J-E-R-O?
I think it's J-E-R-R-E-A-U.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And he put a nation he called the Foundry with a capital at Detroit around the Great Lakes area you have been referencing. But he put another nation called the Breadbasket with a capital of Kansas City, Missouri, south of there, and Champaign-Urbana, where we all are, is in that area.
Well, that is the difference that the linguists make between the North and the Midland, and I think he was right on track. This decision to establish this boundary was done by Hans Corot on the basis of regional vocabulary. But there are other ways of characterizing those cultures. That area in the North was settled by Yankees, and those Yankees came from New England out to civilize the wilderness, and they built frame houses. South of that area, there were individual farmers, upland Southerners, coming and building log cabins.
Well, a lot of those Yankees came across from on the Erie Canal.
Right.
And I just read a good book on that myself. So.
Well, tonight I'm giving a lecture about how this northern city shift started, and I have lots of slides about the Erie Canal, because from 1870 to 1825, that canal was built. Enormous numbers of people came into western New York, and that's what started the whole thing.
Well, thank you, gent.
All right. Then,
well, thank you.
Is there also you talked about this shift, this vowel shift that's going on in this northern region. Is there also something like this, a different kind of shift, but also a shift that's happening in the South?
The South has this southern shift, which is quite extraordinary, where it begins with I, as in guy, becoming ga, and followed by a, as in weight, becoming wat. And then beat, as in beaten, becoming bait. In the meantime, the short I sound, as in kid, becomes kid. And the short E word, as in set, becomes so upset. And the A in Danny becomes Danny. So all of that, even more so, we can add to the fact that this caught distinction is in the South is not caught, it's caught, caught.
Well,
and it's you get to go to Laos and you travel on the water. So the South has a whole set of vowel shifts of its own. Now, this Midland area that we're in is different from the North in an interesting way. One of the things we do is play to people the word bus. The bus is with the antennas on the top that we used to travel on, and the word bus becomes a bus. But in this Midland area, it's not that direction. People say the bus. My cousin is on the bus. So they're north of this line, the sound of short U is going back towards A, and south that line is going up towards U. So no wonder people misunderstand each other now and then.
All right. Let's talk again with another caller here. Next is also someone in Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Morning.
Yeah.
I feel like I should have something more substantial to contribute because I'm actually in the linguistics program here. But I just had an anecdote about vowels in Phoenix as opposed to other places where more distinctions are made. When I was in Phoenix, I knew a young man named Aaron, A-A-R-O-N, and they had moved there from New York, and his sister's name was Aaron, E-R-I-N. And, of course, very few people in Phoenix make the distinction between those two vowels, so you would call their house and ask for Aaron, and they would say, speaking, and you would have to ask for the other Aaron. And then when I was living in Boston, a friend of mine was convinced that she could hear a difference between the way I pronounced the three words Mary, Mary, and Mary, even though in my ears they sounded exactly the same, because in her dialect she did have three separate vowels, Mary, Mary, and Mary. So I thought that was really interesting.
Sure is. We have maps of Mary, Mary, and Mary, and just as you said, for most of the country, they're all the same. They're Mary. And in Boston and New York, they can be different. In Philadelphia, where I'm working right now, all those words are different, but Mary and Murray are the same. They're pronounced Murray. So furry and furry are the same for most people. But one of the most interesting things about this Aaron and Aaron thing reminds me of what's happening with the short A word. For many people in America, short A before N becomes Ia. So that one family had a boy named I-A-N, Ian, and a girl named A-N-N, which is the same, Ian. And no one could ever tell who they're calling about.
Did they do that on purpose?
No, it just caught them up without realizing it, that they had named them the same.
So the same as the Aaron example then.
So the words that are spelled with short A are doing different things all across North America, and almost every region is different.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. The next is someone in Atwood. This is line four. Hello.
I was wondering, you say thank you, and I say you're welcome. Could you tell me where the you're welcome comes from?
No, I can't. I think I haven't ever thought about that. It's a part of the history of our language, and I'm going to have to look it up. We have a lot of expressions like goodbye. We can trace that back to God be with you. And we know that other languages use welcome in that sense. But it's one of those things that come down through history that I'll have to get back and see just where it comes from.
Thank you.
All right. To Champagne, then. Line one. Hello.
Hi. What an honor to be able to talk to you. Of course, we studied all about you in Dr. Kotru's social linguistics class many years ago, but he pronounced your name Labau.
Well, you know, just like most linguists, we don't mind if people pronounce the names differently because we enjoy seeing sound change take
right.
place.
Right.
But nevertheless, my name is pronounced by some people Labov, some people Labov, some Labov, and I'm happy to see which way the world takes it.
Right, and I have a question that I'd like to run by you since I teach a lot of international students. I'd like to verify what I'm telling them is actually true. I tell them that people usually take the accent, the pronunciation of their speech community, and so it doesn't matter who their classmates are. It matters who they're living their lives surrounded by, and I always use myself as an example. My parents were immigrants from Serbia, and if I were to have taken their accent as a youngster, it would be very different from how I speak English, but I took the accent of my speech community, even though my parents' accent was very strong, and I spent a lot of time with them growing up. What do you think about that?
Well, you're absolutely right. Every linguist knows that children are going to grow up speaking like the friends around them, and how children manage to discount the foreign accent of their parents, we don't know. But we've done some mixed studies in the outskirts of Philadelphia where we find that for most parts of the Philadelphia accent, it doesn't make any difference when you were came in. If you came in before 15, you're a Philadelphian. But there are other patterns in Philadelphia which you can only get from your parents, and the children who come from out-of-state parents are a little bit different. And in every community, there is that difference. In the Scandinavian Minnesota area, it was difficult to find people who were third generation, so they took second generation people and said, well, are there any differences because their families came from Scandinavia? And it turned out that there were the rarer words, the words that are just about to disappear, you have to get from local parents. But other than that, what you say is true. You talk like your friends, not like your parents.
And why is that? If you've spent more time, especially when you were very young, with your parents, but you end up speaking like your friends.
You've just asked the most important question of my life, because I'm trying to figure out how language changes, and it's little kids who do it, and they do exactly what you described. They pick up they start with where their parents took them. They spend a lot of time with their parents, and yet when they go to school, they move right into the pattern of their children. Not only that, but they carry it further, and they develop the language one step further than even their friends, their older friends. So that's a process that is the secret behind all the questions that people ask me, why does language change so much? It's children who are doing it, and just the way you describe. Mm. And we yet haven't quite figured out how that works.
And in your previous discussion about all the vowel shifts, do we ever find any variance on consonant sounds?
Yeah, the big changes in America are with vowels. That's how we decide to make ourselves different. But R and L, those two consonants, are different. And R, in the eastern cities of Boston, Richmond, New York, used to be pronounced like a vowel, just as in Britain, ka and god, and I adore that part. That changed at the end of World War II. And so throughout the South now, people all pronounce their R's, and most of the time, if you listen to the folks from Boston like Car Talk, you'll hear about 50% R. However, L is disappearing.
And how do we define the difference between a consonant and a vowel? Are L and R sometimes not considered more vowel than consonant?
It's when the tip of your tongue touches the roof of your mouth. So everybody who's listening, say the word L, E-L, the letter L.
L.
And ask yourself, at the end of that word, is the tip of my tongue touching the roof of my mouth? L. Mm-hmm. And I would say over half the people listening here will say, no, it doesn't. At the beginning, if you say la, 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 it will. But at the end of a word, it has become a kind of a vowel, L. So this is causing in some cities even more misunderstanding because in Philadelphia it happens in the middle of a word. So we play a word like rur. What is that word? No one can find it. Then they hear the sentence saying, she smacked my hand with a rur. So the disappearance of L is one of the big changes that's happening throughout America. And our Atlas doesn't report on it because it's too hard to hear on the telephone, but we're going to get after it.
Well, thanks for coming back to Champaign.
All right, thanks for the call. We'll see if we do one or two more callers in the time that remains. The next is also someone in Champaign, line two.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I grew up on the near south side of Chicago, and my friends and I, when we were young, always sort of made fun of the way the kids in the suburbs spoke because we didn't hear that. We didn't seem to speak that way in ourselves. And then when I left that area, everyone was always astonished to learn that I came from Chicago because I didn't have whatever kind of regional signs that the average person would hear. And I always sort of wondered if it had anything to do with the fact that I grew up in a university community and that there were so many people not only from other parts of the country but also from other parts of the world who live there largely. And because my friends didn't speak it with that, you know, doing the things with the E's and the A's that you were talking about, saying test instead of test and sack instead of sock,
right?
For instance, and I was just always curious because nobody's parents that I knew spoke that way. My friends didn't speak that way. And what was it? This little pocket, you know, that's in the city proper on the near south side.
No, I think you're right. My children who grew up in Philadelphia, the youngest ones, do not sound like Philadelphians.
Yeah.
Shame to say. And but that's why when we did this, our first experiments, we went to University of Chicago, of Illinois Chicago Circle.
Uh-huh.
And there we get a very uniform kind of strong Chicago accent among young people. Not that it's absolute, but that's one of the reasons our Atlas shows pretty regular results. Now, we do get some university people who answer the phone, and in that case, if they behave the way you did growing up with your family, they'll be a little different.
Yeah.
So our Atlas is not a social linguistic study of variation within the community. It's showing the big regional patterns that people operate in, and I think that you've described exactly the situation in which people are going to be non-regional. And after all, that's what college education does for you.
Yeah.
Just to one further point. When we play these words to college students, like ga, they don't recognize them as well as high school students do.
Oh.
So when you go to college, you learn a lot of things, and it sometimes confuses you.
I guess, and my parents are both from the East Coast, but I don't think I particularly took any of that on. It really was just in this University of Chicago community. For some reason, that the sort of typical Chicago-isms they just weren't there.
No, the big universities are oriented towards national, international fame.
Yeah,
they want to be the biggest fish in the world.
Yeah.
Whereas the local colleges, people are perfectly happy to be the biggest fish in Chicago.
Yeah. Oh, well, it's interesting. I also lived in the South for a chunk of time and thought that was a riot. They thought I was a riot too. But there were all kinds of interesting, not just vowel differences, but actual, you know, lexical,
right,
kinds of differences, and mashing buttons instead of pressing, and carrying someone home instead of driving, and just I thought it was just really interesting to be there too. But well, it's very interesting your talk.
Good talk.
Well, thanks
Thank
for
you.
The call.
Bye.
We are actually at the point where we're going to have to stop, and I'm sorry that we have some callers that we can't take. Is this just going to keep on going and going and going? Do we ever get, I suppose the answer is no. We never get to a point where language is static and stops changing?
Right. People asked me that question last night and saying, are you going to predict the fact that we will not be able to understand each other? No. We're not a predictive science yet, and lots of things turn around and go the other way. But there is no end to language change. That's the answer that Leonard Bloomfield, a great linguist from Chicago, said. People think it's reached an absolute end, but there's always one step further.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for talking with us. We certainly have enjoyed having you here. William Lebov is one of the country's best-known linguists, has been working in this area as a scholar for a long time, interested in language change and in dialects. And if you're interested in this particular subject, that is the map of dialects in the United States, you can look for the book which he co-authored, The Atlas of North American English. It was published in 2006. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. In part, his visit sponsored by the Department of Linguistics and the Linguistic Student Organization. And again, thank you very much. We appreciate it.